Coming up in the second hour of today's show, it's Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Today, a look at efforts to get more green space in the redevelopment plans for Towson, new practices to control polluting runoff from Eastern Shore Farms, and Rona's trip to areas threatened by natural phenomena and human behavior. Midday on the Bay, after the news at 1. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here. Glad you could join us. In the hour ahead, we'll visit some places in the Chesapeake region from Baltimore to the Eastern Shore that are threatened by human behavior as well as natural phenomena. And we'll hear about a farmer in Talbot County who's figured out a way to control polluting runoff from his land. Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal tells that story. As only she can, Rona is one of the few journalists in our region who can make ditch digging and chicken manure interesting. She joins us once a month for Midday on the Bay, produced in collaboration with Rona's employer, the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Welcome back to the show, Rona. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you.
And we'll get to the stories I mentioned in the second half of the hour. But up front, the subject is open space and green space, and how much space should developers allow when they build apartment buildings, new houses, and retail centers when they develop or redevelop urban centers? That question frames a discussion about Towson, the county seat of Baltimore County, where some big redevelopment plans are in play now. But community leaders and environmentalists believe not enough open space is being included in those plans. They think there should be more and that developers should help pay for it. So, Rona, why don't you set up this discussion for us before I introduce our other guests?
Well, the discussion in Towson over open space has often centered on ball fields and how we don't have enough of those for kids to play. And that's a very important issue, of course, and I'm hoping our guests will talk a little bit about that. But open space is also important for other reasons that sometimes get forgotten. Open space is crucial for stormwater. We are now having a crisis with stormwater in the whole country, and particularly Maryland. We need to figure out ways to slow down the water as it comes out of the stormwater systems. And a great way to do that is through parks and green space and sort of filter areas. It also reduces the heat island effect. It makes your community so much more beautiful. It adds to your property values. It brings back species. It helps water quality, and on and on and on and on. There are so many benefits to green space. And yet, we have these five large developments coming into Towson that are taking up some green space, but they're redeveloping some concrete. And there's an opportunity for us to try to get more green space within our community. And it doesn't seem as though there's a push at the administration level to make that happen.
Okay. And the developments we're talking about have been in the news over the last year or so, more than that. Towson Row, let's see, that's at York Road and Towson Boulevard, also Susquehanna Avenue in Chesapeake. 101 York Road, Towson Muse is the name of another development, Towson Square. And so that's what's in play. And there's another one called The Flats that we'll hear about. I want to welcome to the show David Marks, who is the Baltimore County Councilman serving the 5th District, who introduced some legislation that focuses on developers and open space. David Marks, nice to have you on the show with us.
Great to be here.
And Mike Ertel is president of the Greater Towson Council of Community Associations. Mike Ertel, nice to have you on the show with us.
Thank you.
The Greater Towson Council of Community Associations, would you mind just explaining to folks? I think everyone knows what the county council is, but what is
that's a lot
the greater,
to spit out.
yeah, what's the GTCCA?
So what we are is we are the umbrella group that the 30-plus neighborhoods of Towson belong to. So all the neighborhood associations tend to have pretty strong boards in Towson, and but there's still an issue of the bigger picture. And in the mid-70s, the neighborhood saw the need to have a larger organization where they could try to speak with one voice and deal with issues that are kind of larger than just their particular neighborhood.
We should point out to folks who don't already know this, Towson actually is not an incorporated town or city, as there are others. There are a few others in Maryland, but it's not. It does not have a mayor. it has council members who serve different parts of Towson, mm-hmm. right, David Marks?
That's correct. There are four of us serving Greater Towson.
What piece of Towson do you have? Is it hard to describe, or is it the...
No, I have the downtown core, the neighborhoods along York Road.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your concerns in terms of the development that's in place, developments that are in place, and this issue of open space and what you're hearing from constituents.
First, I think we need to look at the positives. I mean, there's a lot of good things happening in Towson. The redevelopment of Towson is going to be very positive for Baltimore County. It's going to generate jobs and tax revenue, and I think it's going to be a plus for the community. And Towson is a great cosmopolitan community, but clearly my constituents are telling me we need to do more on open space. And it's not just ball fields. It's also greenways, trails. It's a circulator. It's all the ingredients that make a sustainable community, which is, I think, what we aspire to become.
And so you don't mean just green space, actually making it a greener Towson in general, looking to the future?
Absolutely. It's walking trails, it's getting people around, and it's dealing with some of the traffic issues through that circulator.
And Mike, your view on this, Mike Ertel, not your personal view, but what do you hear through the council about these issues? You agree there should be more open space in developers' plans?
Absolutely. It's really a quality of life issue, and I think a lot of people move to Towson because it's central. There's a lot of positive, as David says, there's a lot of positive aspects to Towson. But what we're really concerned about is we have all these projects coming, and it's really going to be, just walls of concrete and no real plans for how they're going, where people are going to escape to. Basically, mm-hmm. when they get out of that building, where are they going to go?
So there's no new park, say, in any of the plans, David?
But there are some parks coming online, though. And, I disagree with the county executive about the open space fees, but I do give him credit for budgeting some money for parks. We're taking Patriot Plaza between the historic courthouse and the new courthouse and making that a green area. We're trying to acquire the Radebaugh property in eastern Towson, and we have two turf fields being built in Towson. So there's at least four projects moving forward. And then there's two other initiatives that we're doing with NeighborSpace. So you have about six projects right now in the pipeline.
Could you explain for our listeners how this works with a developer or a redeveloper wants to do a project? Exactly, what are they required to do in terms of green space and those fees you mentioned?
Well, there's been a mentality in Baltimore County that you need these fees very low to encourage investments. And it goes back way before Mike Ertel was president and I was on the council. And in 2008, for example, there was a development that came in, and the county council waived $1.4 million in open space fees. It went down from $1.4 million to $25,000. And that creates a shortfall over time. So I'm of the opinion that the fees need to go up and that we need to be reinvesting that money back into Towson.
Now, those fees can be used anywhere in the county? I mean, do they go into an open space fund?
Yeah, we changed the law earlier this year to say that any fees from Towson development have to stay within Greater Towson, and Mike's organization was very helpful with that.
Oh, okay, Mike, we want to talk about that a little bit. That does sound interesting because you just don't want the money going into open space in Moncton. You want it to be an open space in Towson, right?
Yeah, the reality is we really need the space there. One of the problems that has really, that we didn't really talk about here is there was a resolution passed back in 2000 that basically said all development in the core of Towson, so downtown Towson, all that development really pays no open space fees. There's some really small fees. I think if you get over 100 units, mm-hmm. you pay $5,000 or something. But conversely, if you built a housing development, let's say in Randallstown, and you built 800 houses, that might kick off somewhere in the neighborhood of $3,000 per house mm-hmm. that could be used to build a park, fix existing infrastructure.
In Randallstown or anywhere?
I think, David, you...
Do you know, David?
It has to stay within the council district.
Within the council district,
right, yeah,
okay.
That's correct.
And that's new. That aspect of it?
That's been there a couple of years.
Okay.
Right.
Now, you wanted to increase the fees, right? Didn't you present a resolution or a bill to the county council about increasing these fees?
Yeah, I wanted at least to go as a stopgap measure to $2,000 per unit, which would be 1,600% higher than the average fee right now. I pulled the bill because both the home builders and the NeighborSpace organization, which is a land conservation group, they wanted a more holistic approach. I understand that, so we'll keep talking about it.
What do they mean? They wanted a more holistic approach.
Well, they raised the point that, you know, we need to be looking at this more comprehensively. That, in other words, our open space policies right now actually encourage developers to tear down trees in an area when you should be retaining that for passive recreational use. And in talking to my council members, I think they wanted us to look at this just more comprehensively than just Towson.
Hmm. What about negotiating with the developer, not so much over fees, but over actual space and square footage? You know, if you want to build a high rise of a certain square footage, there needs to be a certain square footage that's green, that's grass, that's trees, that's flowers, that's, you know, a nice place for the residents there to walk through and sit in, maybe.
Right. And I think that's what most people believe that can happen. The reality a lot of times, especially when you're building in a dense area, is they don't really, you know, if they're going to put up a 20-story building, they don't have an acre to have a park next to it or a garden or something. So that was one of the reasons why these open space waiver fees came about, was to kind of offset for, hey, you can't put the park right there next to the building, but maybe we can buy that vacant piece of land down the road where we could put a beautiful water garden or something.
And so what you'd like to see, I mean, is there still time to influence design and plans? And that's one question. And the second question is, does Towson have a master plan? Is there such a thing for a... I mean, I know that term is used every 25 or 30 years in different communities, right, where you come up with a master plan, a new scheme for sidewalks and streets and trees and gardens and parks.
We're having, I think, some successes. Towson Muse, which is a townhouse development in eastern Towson, we worked with the community there. We created a pocket park there, and we're going to be using some money to actually rehabilitate an older area in that community. So that's a real success. The second thing is with Towson Row. And Towson Row is a transformational project. It's going to have a lot of other green elements. But we're talking to the developers of that about building possibly a pedestrian bridge across York Road and helping to create eventually a Towson Greenway. So I think, you know, you can negotiate with these developers. I think there's a lot of good people of good faith, and we can get some good projects. Regarding the master plan, a lot of what we do is dictated by the Baltimore County Master Plan. But the problem is that Towson has about a dozen different zoning districts. So I'm trying to create one unified overlay district that's easy to understand and that promotes some elements of sustainability.
Wow, that does sound complicated.
It's very, it's,
yeah,
it's,
good luck with that.
And it's confusing for developers as well as the community.
Just to mention Towson Row, this is a Caves Valley Partners development.
Yes.
Rona's notes, $300 million redevelopment, 200,000 square feet of office space, 100,000 square feet of retail, 350 high-rise apartment and condo units, 200-room hotel, and then the student housing is part of this, too, because this is near Towson University, right? This is Towson Now Boulevard, Susquehanna Avenue, Chesapeake, 300 student housing units, 1,000-space parking garage, and that's according to the Baltimore Business Journal. Rona?
Well, I just wanted to say that one of the ways that my neighborhood got really upset and other neighborhoods in Towson is we had a meeting, the county had a meeting with Caves Valley, and they told us at the meeting that this massive development, all they had to pay in open space offsets was $55,000. And for a $300 million plus development, a lot of people thought that was insignificant, to say the least. And also that $55,000 of open space, they could put that open space somewhere else besides the Towson, because it's an offset. So they could put it, I don't know, Lutherville, but someplace kind of out. And I think that statement made people realize how things had really gone off the rails in Towson. And I do agree that there's a lot of positive developments, and both Mike and David have done a terrific job trying to let these issues be aired. And David has really pushed for a lot of green space and really good ideas for bike trail. And I think he really understands how important all of this is. But that fact, that $55,000 fact, I think that really created this anger. And you see it in the Towson Times. There's these letters to the editor about it that, hey, you know, what about us? Are you just going to give everything we have in this community away?
And Mike, and then David, I'd like to ask you this. Do you see a new generation of people living around Towson with different attitudes and different views and what they consider priorities? And
since the I guess the end of, I would say, 99 to 2008, till about to crash, we had a massive overturning of the neighborhoods from people that had raised their children there who stayed on another 25, 30 years, mm-hmm. and then suddenly, all of a sudden, there's all these new families in the area. Hmm. We had all the elementary schools, actually all of our schools, overcrowded. The county closed schools back in the 70s and didn't have any plan for what they were going to do when the area repopulated. Well, the area is repopulated, and one of the reasons why we're so mad about this issue is this resolution went in 2000. Resolutions are supposed to be used for 2 or 3 years at best. They've been the county.
Which resolution?
A resolution 6400 is the actual number. It was a resolution that set the fees for open space waivers in Towson at basically zero.
Okay.
I mean, there, like I said, there are some small fees.
And you're saying it's still in place in practice.
The county's been using that as a template. So when a developer comes, they say, well, basically you have no fee other than, you went over 100 units, so now you're going to pay $5,000. You're building this giant building.
I see.
Dormitories.
That's why David wanted to increase the fees.
Right. So David has tried to address that. We've collaborated.
We're talking. Talking
to developers?
No, talking to the community and the developers. The community has an important perspective, and Mike has been very active in addressing that.
Another group that's formed is a newly formed group called the Green Towson Alliance, and I wanted to mention I received a letter from them today. I wanted to read on the air. We want to see Towson developed as a green city that will provide a pleasant, attractive, and clean environment for people who live, work, and visit the area. This may appear to be somewhat more complicated, expensive, and time-consuming compared to the current development model in Towson, which is highly profit-oriented. However, you get what you pay for, and Towson has a long history of failed major developments, which have cost the taxpayers dearly. This time around, we want to see it succeed. We strongly believe the county and the Towson developers need to take advantage of modern advances in the design of safe, healthy, and environmentally sustainable communities. Our group has been calling for this since February. We know Councilman Marks has heard us, and we expect he will work on all our behalf to build a green city. We hold him to that. It says a green city means green roofs, trees and sidewalk gardens in great abundance, alternative energy, stormwater absorption, Rona, you mentioned that, or recycling on site, and a design that prioritizes pedestrians and bicyclists. Do you want to comment here, or should I?
Sure.
A couple more paragraphs.
Sure. I mean, this is a great group. I mean, these are very well-meaning folks, very engaged, very intelligent, and we've had some great conversations. I will say that if you want to look at what the developers of Towson Row can do, look at Towson City Center. I think that's a great project. It's a very energy-efficient project, and I'm very hopeful for what we can get done at Towson Row. In terms of the green elements, that's what I'm trying to do with the overlay zone. I think there's some give and take. The developers talk about things like parking, where maybe we can have some more flexibility, reduce parking. That's actually a more environmentally friendly thing to do. Hmm. But also beef up our sustainability requirements. Look at green roofs, look at streetscapes, look at pathways. That's what I want to do with the overlay zone.
Did you mention a circulator earlier?
Yes.
Is that part of the plan for Towson?
Yeah, it's part of my plan. The county council is going to be considering a resolution to formally endorse a pilot program for a circulator. And Mike's group has been part of the discussions of this. Governor Hogan, to his credit, has funded the planning for this. When the county government hasn't supported it, per se, but the state is helping us with planning. And I think this is absolutely key. I think we absolutely have to increase mobility. We have to do it through a circulator, biking, and pedestrian, better pedestrian linkages.
Let me finish reading the letter from the Green Towson Alliance, and you can find a link to their Facebook page on mine. We will continue making our views known and educating the public on the consequences of county and developer plans and actions when they do not promote the development of a green, forward-thinking Towson, especially when they result in waiver or loss of normal governmental checks and balances. We invite the listeners to look at our first white paper just published about the proposed rezoning of downtown Towson and express their views to their elected county representatives, the press, and us. And on their Facebook page is that white paper they refer to. I want to thank Mike Ertel for being here, president of the Greater Towson Council of community associations, and David Marks, councilman of the 5th District, representing Towson. Well, actually, what did you say? You go from Bologna Avenue all the way to Harford County, your 5th District.
That's it.
Well, thank you for being here, both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we'll keep our eye on Towson and green space. A short break on Midday, and when we come back, Midday on the Bay, more with Rona Cabell. She's going to tell us about a farmer in Talbot County who came up with an interesting plan for dealing with runoff from his farm, and then a little journey that Rona took this weekend with some other eco-journalists. So this is Midday on the Bay. You're welcome to join us with comment about anything you hear here. 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday, Midday on the Bay. Remember this phrase, wilderness in Baltimore. We'll get to that before the end of the hour with Rona Cabell. You can join us with comments or questions for this edition of Midday on the Bay, 410-662-8780. Mike in Towson had a comment about the last segment we just did on green space, open space in Towson. Welcome, Mike.
Hi.
What did you want to say?
I'm one of those people who regularly or frequently recently wrote into the Towson Times and encouraging them to do more with green space. My wife and I moved here about 18 months ago from upstate New York because we were familiar with Towson and enjoyed a great deal. What we saw happening after we got here and purchased a house was rather disappointing. And it occurred to me that why couldn't developers pay a percentage of a fee of the project? For instance, a $100 million project would warrant 1% or $1 million worth of payment to the county for green space maintenance and development.
It makes sense to me. It sounds like it's something that's negotiated away rather quickly.
Right. I mean, I think there was a time when we needed to encourage people to come to Towson because people didn't want to. And I think that time has passed. Towson is a desirable place to be. There's a lot of people living there. It's a really good place for businesses and for people to locate. And I agree that given the tight funds of the public sector, that the private sector ought to be required to do more. And this is not something crazy that nobody does. Look at Howard County. They have tons of open space. I know when I covered Anne Arundel County that if you wanted to develop a shopping center, say in Crofton, you were required to offset that with open space in South County if you wanted to build larger than they allowed. So and we did a whole show about Lancaster, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and about all of the innovative things they were doing. And one of the things that they did was every time they had to repave a road, they would put pervious pavement in. Every time they had to redo stormwater, they would do green space. And I personally have had my street torn up all summer, and they've repaved it just the way they would have if this was the 1940s. Same kind of concrete. So I think the developers need to be asked for more, but the county also needs to be thinking in a more innovative way that we can be more than we are.
Well, you know, oftentimes governments, elected officials get very eager and anxious about developers, redevelopments, the prospects of that. Kevin Kamenetz, county executive, has been on the show several times and expressed a lot of excitement about these plans in Towson, and there's reason to be excited about them. But people here are saying, wait a minute, hold on, slow down a little bit here, because this is a new generation. We have different attitudes. We have different desires, priorities. We think Towson can be different aesthetically, more livable. So slow down a little bit here. We don't want to just see a whole bunch of new buildings go up and no room for humanity.
Right. We don't want to live in a mall. We don't want to live in a mall.
Right. This is one more quote here from the Green Towson Alliance. They say that, unfortunately, the green effort is behind the ball, as various county departments have espoused the belief that unless things are done a certain way, Towson will lose the interest of developers. That certain way includes what we view as seat-of-the-pants urban planning, without so much as a master plan. Oh, there it is. There's the phrase. The last master plan for Towson is nearly 25 years old, and much has changed about this town since. The current process has resulted in friction between the county and residents, litigation, and unseemly public arguments. County government tactics, no matter how well-intentioned, have alienated communities and their leaders. And they talk about not having enough notice for public meetings.
Absolutely. That's definitely an issue. I can attest.
Yeah.
That, okay. And they also have the public meetings at, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, whereas I know when I was a reporter in Anne Arundel County, their meetings were always at 7 or 7:30 so that working people could attend. And they were packed meetings, and there was, I'm not going to say it was, you know, wine and roses. I mean, there were certainly disagreements, but it seemed like Anne Arundel County, when I covered it, was quite responsive to the needs and the questions of the constituents. And you get the impression, you know, given when they have the meetings, that they're not that interested in people coming.
Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal. This is our Midday on the Bay edition. 410-662-8780 if you'd like to join us. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Rona Cabell is one of the few writers who can make ditch digging and chicken manure interesting. It's because as a reporter for the CBJ, she spends a lot of time talking with and about farmers and how their practices affect ultimately the Bay. That means chicken farmers, of course, but also those raising crops. And so today I thought this story was interesting, a farmer with about 1,800 acres over in Talbot County, and how he adopted a practice from the Midwest in order to keep excess nitrogen from running off his land. This farmer's name is John Swain. So
John
tell us about him.
So John Swain has a farm in Talbot County, Royal Oak, not too far from the Oxford Bellevue Ferry, in a very beautiful place. And the practice that he put in place is called the two-stage ditch. The two-stage ditch, right. So a regular ditch is kind of trapezoidal in shape. So the water runs down and it sort of collects, and then it has like a crease, and then that crease takes the water down to a stream and then to the river. Mm-hmm. The two-stage ditch, I like to describe it as kind of a split-level home. You have like, so you have the berm, and then you have this vegetation that sort of slopes down, and then it goes into the crease. So when it goes into the vegetation, that vegetation is taking up all of the nitrogen and phosphorus, and it was...
So it's two levels. So it goes into the first ditch and then into the vegetation?
Yes.
Okay.
So we were.
That's the two level, the two stage.
We were teasing John Swain a little bit because he actually has a one stage ditch because there wasn't enough room on his farm is hard by the road, and there wasn't enough room on the other side to put the second berm in. Mm-hmm. So, but he does have a berm on the one side of his farm that's basically collecting the runoff from the farm and then going into the ditch.
What's the idea? Is it that the first ditch doesn't catch enough or catches too much? It just sits there? What's the idea?
There's kind of two ideas. One is it prevents flooding. When you have a huge rainstorm and your ditch is trapezoidal, so the water rushes down each side of the trapezoid and then rushes in, and then the farmer is basically losing water that he could later have used and flooding some of his field. The other part, and the part that makes the ecologists more interested, is the water that's running off the farm and the water that's running off the road is full of nitrogen, phosphorus, other contaminants, and the split level part of the ditch is full of plants, and the plants slow down that runoff and take it up, and so then less water is going into the stream, and so you're basically taking, since all the farms on the eastern shore were, the land used to be much different, and we ditched it so we could farm it. So when you have a two-stage ditch, you're sort of taking the land back to the natural contours and making a very large floodplain, for lack of a better...
I get you. So why did he do that? What prompted John Swain to do that?
The Nature Conservancy and Chesapeake Bay Foundation have been, particularly the Nature Conservancy, have been looking at these two-stage ditch projects all over the country because they've been shown to really reduce phosphorus by almost half. And so the Nature Conservancy was looking for someone to put in a pilot project to see if other farmers would want to do this. And Mr. Swain is pretty active in farm conservation circles down there. So he agreed to be a test pilot. And the Nature Conservancy paid, I think it was $6,000 to install the practice. Unfortunately, nobody told Talbot County about this. And so they came by and they saw the berm was full of vegetation and they mowed it.
You don't want that.
You don't want that.
You
so,
want the vegetation. Which prompts a question from me. Instead of a ditch, why not just a buffer of vegetation, trees, bushes, whatever it is that would absorb more of that runoff? Why not just a buffer around? Is it because farmers don't want to give up? They're giving up more land, more tillable land?
Well, a lot of them are doing buffers, and I press the Maryland Department of Agriculture because they're not doing too many of these two-stage ditches or even one stage. And one of the reasons why is because it's difficult for farmers to give up that much land. The projects in the Midwest that I saw are quite large. Mm-hmm. So what they're doing instead in the Maryland Department of Agriculture is exactly that. They're funding forested buffers and sort of these new wetlands. You take some of your land out of production and kind of make it a wetland, and that all those things absolutely help for sure. And then of course we have other practices like cover crops that are already wildly popular. And the two-stage ditch doesn't really work in a vacuum. You need to combine it with cover crops and other practices so that it can really work as a sponge.
It's an interesting guy. It's interesting to see a farmer making those efforts, even though he's got some help with funding from the Nature Conservancy, right?
Yes, and so. He's been showing his farm to people, and he went to the Midwest to talk about what he's doing because they're really encouraging. I mean, drainage is sort of one of the untapped areas. We've done a lot with farm and conservation and cover crops and buffers and this kind of thing, but we haven't really addressed the ditch situation. And the ditch situation is what gets our water into the streams. And we have a complicated ditch situation in Maryland because Talbot County doesn't have them, but a lot of the other counties have what you call tax ditches. So
tax
ditches, a whole bunch of people together own a ditch. It's like a ditch association. So like you have five or six.
So that ditch over there, I got a piece of that.
So you have or six farmers, and they together own this ditch, and they pay taxes on the ditch, and they maintain the ditch. And so, you know, a whole bunch of people get together. But what happens is a lot of these ditches just become unmaintained because the people in the association have other things to do. And
excuse me, all their runoff is going into the ditch?
Yes.
That's why? So these are farmers on adjoining lands, right?
Right. Hmm. So, like, Virginia doesn't have tax ditches. They have the Virginia Department of Transportation kind of manages the ditches. So the tax ditch is, I don't know if it's just Maryland, but it's kind of a thing that's unique to Maryland or unusual for Maryland. And
never heard of that.
Not all counties have them. So down in like Salisbury, they have them, but up in Easton, they don't. So John Swain was able to do what he did because his ditch is his own ditch and not a tax ditch.
So we've learned about the two-stage ditch and the tax ditch. This is Midday on the Bay. We'll take a little break here. Come back with Rona Cabell. I love when you talk about this stuff. But when we get back, tell us about your weekend trip around the Bay. You went from Blackwater to Baltimore with some other eco-journalists, right?
Yes.
Looking at some problems created by, in one instance anyway, by nature and others by human activity. And also Wilderness Baltimore. With Rona Cabell when we get back. 410-662-8780 is the phone number if you have any comments or questions. So, Rona, I got to tell you, yesterday I was out in a boat out of Middle River, actually Bowley's Quarters, Seneca Creek, went out toward Pools Island, which is sort of in the middle of the bay up in that area, right? And one of the things, we can talk about Pools Island in a moment, but one of the things I found remarkable, and I guess I've noticed this before, it wasn't even that clear of a day yesterday. It was sort of overcast. There was a chop out there, but you could see Towson from there. You could see the top of the Key Bridge. You can see the Eastern Shore. You can see Rock Hall. You can see Fairley Creek. You can... From that vantage, you can just see all those places. And I realize that it's kind of narrow in that section, all things considered, you know.
Yes.
But it's a pretty narrow place in the bay. And you're at Pools Island, you're out in the middle there. It's just remarkable to me that you can sit there in a boat and see all those things all around you, point them out, landmarks, you know.
Yeah, it is. It is remarkable. And I always think it's interesting when people in Betterton over on the Eastern Shore will say, they can hear the booms at Aberdeen.
Yeah.
You think it's a two-hour drive, but it's right there.
Right. So Pools Island, I guess speaking of Aberdeen, APG used to use this, I guess, to test ordnance. And you're not supposed to go on the island because there's unexploded ordnance on that island. It's a nice old lighthouse, too.
Which is too bad, because it would be nice to explore it.
It looks like a beautiful place. So, but it's in the news. It's in the environmental news a bit.
Yes. So underneath Pools Island, right there by where the Patapsco and the Bay meet, is a oyster bar called Man O' War Shoal. And
Man O' War Shoal?
Man O' War Shoal.
I love it. I love it. Oyster bar's got a name like that.
Yeah. My favorite oyster bar name, by the way, is Old Woman's Leg.
Really?
Can you beat that?
Do you know where that came from?
I don't know where it came from, but it's kind of shaped like a kind of bony leg. But when I don't have anything to do, I look through my Chesapeake Bay chart map at all the fun names of treasure wrecks and islands, and that
and oyster bars
always been one of my favorites. But yeah, so Man O' War Shoal, in 2007, the Department of Natural Resources under Martin O'Malley wanted to apply for a permit to dredge oyster shell at Man O' War Shoal. And conservation group, the Coastal Conservation Association, opposed this because they didn't want to disrupt the habitat. And also because they don't really like the idea of just taking a public resource and using it to benefit the oyster fishery.
So why did the O'Malley administration want to do that? They wanted to explain that.
Because we have a shortage, an acute shortage of oyster shell, and we use oyster shell to restore habitats in the bay. So right now there's a project underway. Well, under the O'Malley administration, it was started to take 25% of the public oyster grounds that are fished and turn them into sanctuaries. So to do that, you need to put on fresh shell, and you need to use some shell to set for the oyster spat.
Okay. So all they wanted to do was dredge around Pools Island.
Right. And so this permit thing got hung up in the courts, and the Army Corps of Engineers, which doesn't seem to do anything very quickly, wanted more information. And so on and on it went, and there wasn't any action on it. Even though the legislature required Maryland, the Eastern Shore delegation required Maryland to put in an application for this dredging. So time marches on, and here we are in
8 years later,
2015, and the new DNR secretary is quite keen on getting his permit so that they can dredge Man O' War Shoal. And one of the reasons why is because the water, they've been buying fossilized shell from Florida, and I think at the price of maybe $7 million. And the watermen have not liked this because the shell that they put down to restore the oyster bars is like a fine gravel. It's not really shell. And it's hard for some of the oyster gear to oyster in those places when they're able to oyster again. They expect they will be one day when they're not sanctuaries anymore. So there have been epic fights.
So we need our own shells.
Right. Exactly. We want local shell.
The Coastal Conservation Association or Commission, Association, they're not going to stop without a fight, are they?
They still oppose it. And they might at some point feel more comfortable with it, but they would like assurances as to how much of this is going to sanctuary and what we're going to do with it, and also what happens when we take all the shell from Man O' War Shoal. What do we do then? We haven't really thought about sustainable way to find new shell. And if we're just going to put it on bars and it's going to get harvested and we're going to lose it, you know, then we're no better. We've just bought some time. That's their argument. So it's it's continuing to. There have been some.
There's nothing else you can put down in an oyster sanctuary.
Well, that's a really good point. There have been other attempts to do things. Concrete. The Wilson Bridge has been used to make reefs, and there are other substrates that you can use. New Orleans, Louisiana is experimenting with lots of different things, but nothing works like shell. That's the best. So I think people see that we have this sort of gold mine of shell and they want it. But the fisherman argument is that, the marina you went out with, Bowley's Quarters and other places, that fishing is prime fishing habitat. And if you start kicking up sediment and dredging, will it continue to be so?
Right.
That's the question.
It's a beautiful spot out there at Pools Island. So, Rona, where'd you spend the weekend? I got a text from you from Blackwater Wildlife Refuge.
Yes.
Sanctuary. And then later, a photograph of you and your colleagues in Leakin Park in Baltimore. So you guys did some hoofing on Saturday. This was part of Natural Resources Writers Group?
Yes. It's called the Institute for Journalists and Natural Resources resources, and it's a terrific group that runs fellowships for journalists and all over the country. And I had been trying to get them to come to Chesapeake Bay to do a trip, and so it was actually a 4-day trip, and we started in Baltimore with Leakin Park and Stormwater and Trash and Blue Water Baltimore and some neighborhood groups in Patterson Park. And then we did a day on TMDLs and
You did a day on total
maximum daily loads,
which refers to pollution and the Environmental Protection Agency's standards for the Chesapeake Bay. Thank you very much.
And the reason this was so important is because, and actually the journalists were very interested in it, because we have the largest large TMDL in Chesapeake Bay. Other states have
total maximum daily load. That's how they pronounce it in Balmer.
Load. Yeah. Okay, so we have a large regulatory framework to clean up the bay here, and other places don't have that yet, but it's probably coming there. So this was sort of a preview of things to come.
Where were these journalists from?
Oh, all over. So we had someone from St. Louis, someone from Tel Aviv. Okay. We had a Tel Aviv. We had a woman from Reedville, a reporter from Canada, someone from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Okay.
All over. A guy from Bainbridge Island who reports at a newspaper out there.
Was there sewage in Leakin Park?
Yes, we went to the outfall. There wasn't as much trash as I'd hoped to show people how bad it can be, but it was pretty stinky, and we went through this sort of brambles and down to look at it. So
let's talk about Blackwater. So you made a trip to Blackwater, and I posted a photograph that I got from you on Facebook and asking what is wrong with this picture, because there's something wrong there.
Right. So what's wrong with that picture is you shouldn't be able to see the water between the marshes. That used to be one big intact marsh. And since the 80s, Blackwater has lost about 5,000 acres of marsh. And Mike Slattery from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service told us that when he started working at Blackwater, you couldn't see any water. It was all marsh. But what's happened is we have sea level rise, we have land sinking, and then this like very salty incursion of water that kills everything. And when you see, when you're driving, to me, one of the most striking views in all of Maryland is when you're driving to Blackwater and you see those dead trees coming out of the salt marsh. Do you know what I mean? Like there's no leaves on them.
Right.
And a lot of times they're in kind of a stage of almost falling down. Mm-hmm. And I have a friend who's a longtime oysterman, and he says, when I was a kid, that was all land. You couldn't, it was all trees and it was a forest, and now look at it. And so I think one of the reasons that we went to Blackwater was to show people sort of the front lines of climate change and how things are really evolving very fast, and that there are people who are not that much older than we are who in their lifetime saw it much different.
So we've talked about a couple things here. You mentioned the trash and sewage outflow at Leakin Park in Baltimore, but this, well, I guess you could say it's influenced by humans.
Right.
But it is mostly a natural phenomenon, would you say? How do you quantify that?
Well, I think, the climate change is exacerbated by our use of fossil fuels and what it's doing to the atmosphere. And Blackwater is no exception. About a third of our pollution is coming from the air. And so I think together, you don't notice it so much in your daily life, because for a brick house and a regular lawn, it's not making a huge change. But in a place like Blackwater, where a marsh ecosystem is so sensitive and so dependent on clean water and a certain amount of fresh water, that you can really see it.
What about nutria eating the grasses? Someone posted on Facebook that theory that that's what's wrong with that picture.
Oh, well, that was true for a long time. And one of our big success stories here is the eradication of nutria. I did a story on it a few years ago that they had pretty well trapped all the nutria and gotten them. And that was a big problem. And when we were at Blackwater, Matt Whitbeck of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said he'd been there since, I think, 2008, and he had not seen a nutria. Hmm. They're pretty well gone now. So, good news.
Okay, so interesting trip that you made. You did some trekking around the bay.
Yeah, and one thing that I really like to do is to show people Baltimore, because it's been my home for the last 15 years, and I love the city, and I'm always I always enjoy watching people's reaction. You probably do too when they when they see Baltimore and they say, "Wow, it's really nice," and I didn't expect to see that. And
they're kind of shocked, actually.
Yeah, and then and I mean, we didn't. It wasn't all sugarcoating it. We did have a day where we talked about lead poisoning, and but I think they were really impressed with how well the city is laid out and how beautiful it is, and they loved seeing the neighborhoods and all the kind of unique things we have here.
And speaking of unique things, wilderness. I don't know how much wilderness we have in Baltimore, but this whole idea seems incongruous, those two words, wilderness in Baltimore. But you came from an interesting meeting today on this subject.
Yes, I was at the Patuxent Research Refuge in Laurel, which is where Rachel Carson did her work, this enormous wildlife refuge in Laurel, Maryland. And it was a seminar on the Baltimore wilderness. Chicago did this a few years ago. They sort of put together all of their conservation groups, nonprofits, government, and made a partnership to kind of create this network of trails and green space. And so the people involved in the Baltimore effort brought the person who led it in Chicago here to tell us kind of how he did it and what we might want to emulate from that. And so there's a lot of excitement on this issue because Baltimore has an amazing amount of green space that we're not using. And there's this idea that we could sort of weave it together and make good public spaces.
So the use of the term wilderness is to get people excited, not to really restore wilderness. That's not going to happen.
Well, I mean, I would agree with you, except my editor, Carl Blankenship, told me that, as I was telling him about this, and he said that he was on the light rail not too long ago through Baltimore, and he saw three coyotes.
On the light rail. Coming through the probably the Woodbury area,
Cold Spring
around there.
Not riding the light rail, but out So I mean, to me, like, that says to me, there is wildlife in Baltimore, and I understand there are a lot of coyotes in Chicago. Not that that's good, but necessarily, you don't really want them walking down the street. But I think there is these pockets of wildlife.
And there's great potential for you use the term weaving things together.
Yes,
Along the rim of the Inner Harbor, the Port Covington, Westport is going to be redeveloped there. The opportunity to, do it in a green way and then connect it to downtown and up through the Central Corridor there, the Jones Falls Valley, which is what Carl's talking about there, out to the light rail. Mm. There is potential there.
Yeah, and I would say, though, I mean, Tim Wheeler did a really terrific story in The Sun about the sewage problem in Baltimore and our woeful ability to get it cleaned up. And, one thing about the weaving of that together is there's a lot of parts of Baltimore that are beautiful, but they still stink.
Yeah.
I mean,
you got to get the sewage system and the storm drain system straightened out.
Right,
there.
Because who wants to ride a bicycle along a fetid stretch of
Did you say fetid?
Fetid.
I say fetid.
Fetid.
You say fetid. I say fetid. Boy, does it stink. Either way, right. I know what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, and I mean, it makes it, I mean, I love Robert E. Lee Park, but it stinks sometimes, So you want to encourage people to go and enjoy these things and not be turned off by the fetid odors.
Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Are we down to our last minute together here? Okay, good.
Oh, my goodness, we are.
Yeah, so it was announced that I'm leaving the show October 2nd, so this will be our last Midday on the Bay together. So
I know.
Anyway, it's been great, Rona. It's great having you contribute your knowledge and experiences in our understanding of the ecology of our region here, the Chesapeake region. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
You're
it's been a
person.
Career highlight to work with you.
Same here. Thank you very much, Rona.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our Midday for today. We'll be back again tomorrow. Have a great afternoon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Beatrix Lockwood, Adam Dronberg, and Aaron Morenzi. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.